You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
You're listening to the Archaeology Show. TAS goes behind the headlines to bring you the real stories about archaeology and the history around us. Welcome to the podcast. Hello and welcome to the Archaeology Podcast, episode 40. I'm Chris Webster.
And I'm April Camp Whitaker. On today's show, we talk about deep time in ancient Australia with historian Billy Griffiths.
Let's dig a little deeper. Okay, welcome to the show. How's it going, April?
It's going really well.
Awesome. So, you know, we've had some really great interviews lately. We've interviewed some authors about their books, and the fun is not stopping right now. We've got another great author on with a great book that we had an advanced copy of that April and I got to take a look at, and it's really interesting. And quite frankly, something as North American archaeologists, both April and I, that we don't have a lot of interest, or not interest, we have interest, and we hope you do too, but that we don't have a lot of experience in. So, and that is Australian archaeology and sort of the history of Australia and what's going on. And to discuss that, we're bringing on Billy Griffiths. And Billy is a historian with interests in Indigenous history, political history, deep history, and the history of science. His research at Deakin University in Australia encourages a dialogue between the sciences and the humanities and explores the challenges and possibilities of citizenship in a settler nation with deep Indigenous history. His latest book is called Deep Time Dreaming, Uncovering Ancient Australia, and is available from Black Ink Books. The link for that is in the show notes. Welcome to the show, Billy.
G'day. Good to be here.
Okay. So why don't you just start off by telling us, what is this book about? We'll get into you a little later, but I want to just hit it right off with the book. So if people want to go download this or take a look, maybe even as they're listening, then they'll have that. So what is this book about? What's your elevator pitch for it?
This book is a history of some of the people, places, and ideas that have shaped the way we think about ancient Australia. So that deep time story. So it's a history of archaeologists and their relationships with their archaeological sites. It's also a personal journey into what it means to live in a land of great antiquity with its complex questions of ownership and belonging. So I look at a series of different archaeologists of the last half century or so that have transformed the way we understand Australian history, enlarged it enormously, and I'll go into their methods, their passions, their mistakes, and I follow their lives in trying to unravel this big story of really shifting understanding of what Graham Clark thought, that the archaeologist Graham Clark described Australia as the last continent to be colonized in 1961. And we've had this massive shift since then, where Australian history now goes back to 65,000 years, making it older in terms of Homo sapien history than Europe, and quite a quick dash from out of Africa, I suppose, coming to Australia. So it's become part of a global story. So that's my elevator pitch, I suppose.
Well, that's great. And I love the format of this book too, because it's a history book. It's about, you know, the history of Australia and beyond that, but it's told like a series of biographies, which I love science biographies and hearing how people do things. And honestly, I had no idea that Graham Clark committed suicide. Like, I had no idea about that.
Gordon Child.
Mm. I mean, sorry, Gordon Child. Yeah. Wow. Sorry, Graham. Didn't mean to step on you there. But Gordon Child, sorry. It was fascinating listening to that and reading about that. And then just the way that you've got the thing structured here as sort of like mini biographies, but talking about how they discussed Australian history. How did you come up with that? What made you come up with that format?
Well, I'm drawn to people's lives. And I think, you know, when archaeology, as with all science, is not a simple set of answers. It's an ongoing inquiry, and the answers you get out of it are bound to the attitudes and methods of those who produce that knowledge. So I wanted to dive deep into these characters, and the archaeologists form fantastic characters. They are full of, and the Australian archaeologists full of great stories. So I was drawn to approach it that way. I start with Gordon Child's suicide in the Blue Mountains as this kind of moment in time. He comes back to Australia in 1957 after 36 years abroad, having been banished from Australia because of his socialist politics, and he couldn't get a job at a university here. Wow. So he went across and became the great synthesizer of European archaeology. And he returned to Australia and was he despaired at the lack of interest in the deep past in Australia, and in the lack of public interest in Indigenous history, which. Yeah, so he was so frustrated that there were so few people looking into this. So I pick up with this frustration, this moment of frustration in the 1950s, which then is followed by a few lone practitioners in the form of John Mulvaney and Isabel McBride, and then soon a bustling community of archaeologists who work on every part of the continent to unravel an extraordinary and varied human history here.
So really quickly, can you just, from our listeners who are not archaeologists and have maybe gone through an intro to anthropology archaeology class, can you just give us like a two-word sentence about who Gordon Child was and what he was doing in Australia?
Okay, he was, Gordon Child was the great synthesizer of European archaeology. He wrote The Dawn of European Civilization, among other books, but that's his classic, which was the textbook everyone used for a good half century. And he came back to Australia because he wanted to return to the country of his youth. He is an Australian archaeologist. He's the most famous of them all in a way, but he never worked in Australia. And he came back to Australia to see the sights of his youth, to visit his sisters, to smell the Blue Mountain air. Right, the Blue Mountains is a beautiful community just inland from Sydney, and then ultimately he walked those cliffs in the Blue Mountains to find a place where he could end his life, because he was worried that he was losing his grasp, intellectual grasp of all the information he had at his fingertips. He was losing his ability to grasp dates and names and just very slightly, but he had a remarkable mind and obviously felt that was something he didn't want to bear, losing that loss. Not quite a two-word sentence, sorry.
it was a wonderful synthesis. That's a great insight into who he was and kind of his personality. And I think also for many archaeologists and academics, the importance of kind of knowledge as a central part of our being.
I think he wrote in there because he mentioned in one of his communications prior to his death, kind of writing his own obituary, like I think you mentioned in the book, that he kind of wanted to go out on a high note. I sort of like that. Like he's like, hey, I've done all the things and I don't want to be old and feeble. So I'm going to kind of take care of it now. I don't know. I don't think any of us would have the guts to really do that, but I think we can all understand it.
Yes, so and you think, he was only 65, so he had so much life ahead of him if he'd held on. It's a tragedy, but you can see his thinking. I explore his interactions with one of the few archaeologists that was working in Australia at the time that Child returned, and that was John Mulvaney, who's gone on to become known as the father of Australian archaeology. And he was instrumental. He had a different vision for archaeology in Australia because he for starters, he thought you could dig to find antiquity here. He wanted to approach Aboriginal history as a history. In the mid-20th century, the field of archaeology was grouped by cultural evolutionists, those who collected stone tools and confounded the tools with the cultures that had left them and created them. And they didn't dig because they didn't think there was anything to find. There was this prevailing assumption, as famously expressed by Robert Pulleine, that Aboriginal people were an unchanging people living in an unchanging land. And this sounded didn't sound right to John Mulvaney, who went across to Cambridge University to train and then came back to Australia to excavate sites on the huge river in the middle of Australia, Murray River. At the mouth of the Murray River, he excavated a deep trench and uncovered a layered occupation, which was counter to this idea that that people hadn't been here long enough to leave such a trace.
Man, that is so crazy that that people would just make that assumption and just not dig based on what they know. That's so crazy. What are some? That's one of my big questions I have for you. What are some of the major misconceptions about Australian history that have been corrected in with the people that you focus on in this book and the work that they did? What are some of the major misconceptions people had about the history of Australia? Besides they weren't here very long.
Yeah, so that it was short, that it was that Australian history, Indigenous history, wasn't very complex, that it was static, that people weren't seen as having a history. So they were seen as a Western stage in human evolution. Now seen as primitive, as a type, a stepping stone to Western societies today. So that was evolutionary thinking at the time, and what we've moved on from is to understand that this is an incredibly varied history of not just one culture but hundreds of cultures, and these people who made this land their own through language, song, story, and fire, they endured dramatic environmental transformations. They were here for such a long time that they witnessed the full last ice age, last glacial maximum, and the millennial long floods that followed it. So what we piece together is the ways that they transformed their environment. As well, we shifted from thinking this idea of hapless wanderers in the land to understanding the ways in which Indigenous people managed the land through fire, through creating, crops, through digging and sowing murnong or yams. So we've become our understanding of the complexity of these societies has evolved enormously thanks to the vast few decades of archaeology in this country.
That actually is really interesting. I think, at least coming from the States, there's almost kind of a dichotomized view of Australian history where there's this very like colonial Western viewpoint where it's sort of this empty continent and then we start sending people there and arriving there and colonizing it. And then there's also sort of these very stereotyped in a way views of the Aboriginal populations there. And the communities that are still existing, just sort of based on what little cultural pieces have filtered over kind of the expanses and oceans and been conveyed through movies and pop culture. So I think it's really interesting to think about how those archaeology kind of brings these two things together. But also, can you talk a little bit about what these Aboriginal cultures really are like? And just tell us a little bit more about it, since I think a lot of our listeners aren't necessarily even conscious of the fact that these are groups that are still very culturally vibrant today and had this long history and kind of what their structure is. I mean, we're really much more familiar with the native populations of our own nation.
Indeed. And this is you've captured the story at the heart of the book, really, which is that it became as a revelation to so many Australians and so many of the people I write about too, that Aboriginal peoples had survived the invasion, that they were still here. There'd been such a long understanding that they were a dying race, that they were not they were not long for this world, and that changed dramatically. And this is the story I tell in this book. So this isn't just the history of archaeologists and their relationships with archaeological sites, but it's also the story of Aboriginal leaders and their fight to have a voice in decisions that are being made about their land and their heritage. So you've got this strident new strident voice that's emerging in the 60s and 70s, which is changing the way we think about heritage, but also got this wrong connection. In Aboriginal people today, they feel a deep connection with this past, and they have a deep connection. You've got this immense cultural continuity despite the ravages of dispossession. And the archaeologists had to come to terms with this, this awakening, I suppose. And that's what I follow in the book is the way that they change their practices to be more inclusive, the way they work to involve Indigenous voices in heritage legislation, for example, the way that they stopped, seeking permission from relevant Indigenous groups before excavating on their land, before that wasn't seemed necessary because there wasn't any understanding that there was anyone just there to ask. So okay. Your misconceptions about from North America, I think, are very much an Australian psyche as well, and we're still coming to terms with this deeper story. There's very frustratingly little information or understanding about this, the long and varied Indigenous history of this continent, and that's one of the things I'm really trying to communicate in this book is to urge the Australian public as well as people overseas to open their eyes to this rich history, which has so much to tell us. And when we start grappling with the incredible variety of human experience here.
Okay, well, we are going to dive into that a little more on the other side of the break. However, I just got to say, while we're still on this, it seems like if somebody wanted a thesis or dissertation topic, all they'd have to do is look for like the shortest Wikipedia or encyclopedia entry in a book and find out that, hey, it's more complex than we thought. It's like, that's the story of all sciences right now, especially archaeology and history, isn't it? The minute somebody dives deep into something, they're like, wow, this is way more complex than we ever thought possible. And it seems like that should just be a no-brainer at this point. We should just need to find that complexity and then tell people the story of it, not assume there is no complexity. So, yeah. Okay. Well, we are going to be back in just a second for more discussion of the book Deep Time Dreaming with Billy Griffiths. This network is listener supported. We're trying to move away from paid advertising while also creating new shows and supporting the ones we have. The APN has never and will never make a serious profit on our podcast. Every little dime we make goes back into the network and improving show quality. So become a member today at www.arcpodnet.com/members to show your support, get some extras, and be a benefactor for archaeological education. Members get stickers, a coffee mug, a t-shirt, bonus content, early access to episodes, a private Slack team to talk to other members and the hosts, and full access to training on Team Black over at arccert.black. So check out our memberships at www.arcpodnet.com/members today and support archaeological education. That's www.arcpodnet.com/members. Now back to the show. Okay, we are back on the Archaeology Show, episode 40, in a discussion with Billy Griffiths of his book Deep Time Dreaming, all about Australia. It's Uncovering Ancient Australia is the subtitle of the book. So, Billy, you know, we've talked about some kind of high level concept with this and some big terms in Australia history. Let's get a little deeper into this story. And why don't you tell us about, you know, one of the people from your book and let's dive deep into their story.
Great. Yeah. Well, so I talk about founding figures like John Mulvaney and Isabel McBride, who worked hard to rein in the destructive culture of surface collecting and to educate the broader public and the importance of recognizing, protecting Aboriginal sites. But perhaps no one did more to transform lay understandings of ancient Australia than the restless and romantic Welsh archaeologist Rhys Jones, who had the ability to inspire awe and wonder about the deep past by conjuring phrases and images that could carry his ideas. He was a gift to journalists, especially who sought to understand the deep history of Australia, because of his breathless manner and his penchant for performance. Novelists thinly fictionalized his rugged larrikin character, and Australian Playboy devoted a 7-page feature to his vision of ancient Australia. He was heralded in the press as, due to his diminutive stature, the Welsh leprechaun, the prehistory cowboy, and yes, Australiana Jones.
Wow.
So he pioneered an understanding of Tasmania's Aboriginal past, in particular. So Tasmania is the island at the bottom of mainland Australia. It looks like a heart. He was born in Wales and he came across from Wales after training in Cambridge. He landed in Sydney and was given a PhD topic delivered to him. You know, these days a PhD topic might be have a look at the faunal remains in this specific site, or let's have a understanding of microliths. And for him, it was what happened in Tasmania. There's a state. That's your PhD topic. So he embarked on this grand unraveling of Tasmanian Aboriginal history, where he challenged these expectations and preconceptions that we just discussed earlier about Indigenous history, and found this story that, you know, this island that was not always an island. People had walked here during the last ice age, and he worked on various sites around the northern coast of Tasmania that spoke to this history of, or this deeper history than anyone had fathomed. But he also paired his work in Tasmania with his work in Arnhem Land, which is in the northern tip of the continent, and he noticed differences in the way that where there's a lot of people still living cultural lives, burning and in Arnhem Land, and he saw the differences between what he regarded as an empty landscape in Tasmania, between the peopled landscape of Arnhem Land. Of course, he came to find out that Tasmania was peopled too, and Tasmanian Aboriginal people got a bit annoyed that he'd neglected them, more than annoyed, angry, and betrayed in many ways. But his pairing of Tasmania with Arnhem Land, you know, that led him to one of his great insights, which I think is one of the central understandings which has been succeeded in being communicated to a broader public, and that's the role that Aboriginal burning played in transforming the environment. He coined the phrase fire stick farming to describe the immense variety of ecological techniques to manage the ecologies for all sorts of reasons.
Wait, did you say fire stick farming?
Fire stick farming. That's right.
Okay. What does that mean exactly? Fire stick.
A fire stick is a burning stick which people patrol the land with and add fire to different areas and in order to spread fire. Spread cool burns. You know, if you burn at the right times, the right places, you change the ecology in a very different way than if you just casually burn. Fire was used to flush animals for hunting, to create pastures, to sow yams, regenerate swamps, you know, burning back the grass around the edges of old swamps, created better conditions for fish and eels. It's his central revelation really changed the way we think about what is a natural landscape and what is a cultural landscape, because there's no wilderness in Australia, because there's been such a depth of human experience here and such a kind of manipulation of the environment over so many generations, that what we see now is the landscape is a human artifact, just as a ploughed field is. That's what led him to make the farming parallel.
Interesting. So how was this burning all-terrain landscape? I mean, you talked a little bit about expanding wetlands, and so what? How I guess this is kind of a more complex question. How has almost the discontinuation of some of, or did the discontinuation of some of these Aboriginal practices change the landscape as we see it now from what they were sort of creating and managing?
That's an excellent question. And it's a question I can only begin to answer a little bit because the stopping of these burning regimes, which have been going on for millennia, so abruptly with the arrival of Europeans, caused all sorts of environmental degradation, which we're still grappling with today. So one of the things it meant was that we don't have we've got more big bushfires than once might have been the case, because there isn't this continuous cool burning going on. So cool burning is low temperature of fires, which the ecology is adapted to, where a hot burn might be, it brings temperatures so high that it just kind of blitzes full habitats and ecosystems, so causing all sorts of troubles, not just for people and their houses, but also for animals and plants. And so the end of the of burning regimes in many places has fundamentally changed our environment, and we're still coming to terms with that. One of the great new initiatives in recent years has been a revival of cultural burning. So this is the survivors, the dispossessed, getting back in touch with their burning knowledge and applying that to different environments in coordination with Western techniques to manage the landscape in a better, in a way that's suited to the landscape, to the environment in Australia. There's burning practice happening in still happening, and I've helped out with burning practices in Arnhem Land in particular, where there's still this cultural burning, and they've got this wonderful system where they burn and they earn money through carbon credits by basically stopping these big bushfires. They are saving a lot of carbon, and that funds ongoing practices on country. So there's all sorts of new ways that reintroducing burning is being used at the moment. Another big cause of the result of the end of Aboriginal burning is that a lot of topsoil just disappeared. It could have forced erosion, and that's exposed whole new archaeological sites in its way, as well as, you know, devastating the land, leaving all the nutrient rich soils in the air. It's also stripped away the landscape to its bare bones, and often revealing new archaeological finds in the process, which is what happened at Lake Mungo.
Wow, that's pretty crazy. And that's yet another thing that we learn from, that we're supposed to learn from history about agricultural practices, you know? That's a story they hear all the time. Is like, now we're farming differently and we're stripping the landscape of its topsoil and its usable elements. So I want to go back to actually the populating of, or the peopling of Tasmania real quick. So I didn't actually know that it was shallow enough there that during the last ice age that people actually walked there. I was going to ask, actually I had a question written down asking about how people got to Tasmania and like when, but is it still relatively shallow between Tasmania and Australia? And actually, how close is it? I mean, what kind of a distance are we talking here now?
Hundreds of kilometers. It's a very long way away now. It's shallow, but it's not very shallow. It's a huge strait there, shipping strait, crossing between mainland Australia and Tasmania. So people did walk there, so while people have been in Australia, the sea level has risen 125 meters.
Jeez.
I know, it's an enormous amount, not one or two, but 125 meters. So Australia was once connected. I know, as recently as you know, 10,000 years ago, but really at the height of the last glacial maximum, 21,000 years ago, Australia was connected to Tasmania by land and also to Papua New Guinea. And this is the vast greater continent of Sahul that was originally colonized and by these voyaging parties about 65,000 years ago. So in order to get to Australia, the first Australians had they voyaged here. They on crafts crossing over 100 kilometers of open water to a land that lay beyond the horizon. They couldn't see Australia before they set out on that voyage. That, you know, clouds billowing above the land may have pointed the way, or migrating birds, but they were voyaging into the unknown when they came to Australia. Mm-hmm. They're probably the best material for their crafts. Coming from Southeast Asia, it was bamboo, which isn't in Australia. So we don't have the sorts of crafts that they used to get here still being made in Australia, there are some archaeologists who are suggesting that there may have been some voyaging between different islands in the Bass Strait. So that's going between Tasmania and Australia in the south of the continent. Island hopping, and that may have had some connections to the mainland. That's still very, very speculative at the moment, but it's a fascinating vein of new research.
So there isn't really, is there a more recent history of like Aboriginal small boat making or anything like that to travel?
There is a very rich history of canoe use and being able to build crafts which can go a long way, which are very small crafts. Mm-hmm. But we don't see the kind of boats or large rafts that people use to come to Australia since then, nor do we see the kind of boats that, say, the Maori used to get to New Zealand. Mm-hmm. But that's because New Zealand history, the Maori came all at once about 900 years ago, whereas Australia has a much, much longer history.
So did they go to New Zealand from Australia or from somewhere else?
Probably. They would have come swept through Polynesia, through Australia, but just swept through islands, Samoa, Tonga, you know, these long island hopping to then cross a very, very long distance to get to New Zealand. So New Zealand was uncolonized. No one was living there 1,000 years ago. Mm-hmm. And then it was founded all at once. That's when Europeans arrived in New Zealand, they were dealing with almost a single voyaging population. So there are of course a variety in the culture, the cultures there, but the newcomers were interacting with an earlier, with a still relatively homogenous group. Whereas in Australia, when the Europeans arrived in Australia, people have been here for so long that there's hundreds of different nations, hundreds of different languages, and they were spread to different corners of the continent. So there wasn't one Aboriginal group that could be dealt with in a way. By dealt with, I mean enter into dialogue with. Or create a treaty with. It's very hard for us to get to conversations about treaty in Australia as much as we need to because of the how many voices there are to treaty with.
Yeah, obviously very similar to North America in that, you know, when people are here for 15,000 years, they're going to generate quite a few different groups. Let's take our final break, and we're going to come up and wrap up this discussion of ancient Australia with Billy Griffiths back in a second. Tired of the webinars and training offered by the big organizations not being free for members and not really covering what we need? Team Black has the answers. Check out arccert.black/main for our upcoming webinar schedule. All of our webinars happen once a month and seating is limited. Learn everything from field tech basics to drones to digital workflows. We have more classes coming online every month. Classes are always 1 hour and cost just $20. Classes like building a CV and getting a job are always free. That's right. We'll help you get a job, then we'll be here when you want to level up your skills. If you are a professional subscriber to the APN at arcpodnet.com/members, then you get all of Team Black's offerings for free as part of your membership. We have Team Black memberships coming that will give the same for the APN. So $20 a month gets you all the APN swag and extras, plus free training from Team Black. So check out arccert.black for more information and level up your skill set today. That's arccert.black. Now back to the show. Hey, podcast fans and digital archaeologists. Have you heard about WildNote? It's a data collection app that works online or offline on your smartphone or tablet, iOS or Android. It allows you to collect field data easily, manage data efficiently, and generate data reports and site records effortlessly. We have a growing list of state site forms built in for your use and some generic forms that will work anywhere. Check out the shovel testing and photograph forms. You can get a free all-access 30-day trial today by going to wildnoteapp.com. That's wildnoteapp.com for your free 30-day trial. Now back to the show. All right, welcome back to the final segment of episode 40 of the Archaeology Show, where we're talking with Billy Griffiths about his book, Deep Time Dreaming, Uncovering Ancient Australia. And check out the link in the show notes for a link to that book. So, Billy, as a historian, I'm sure all historians experience this too. And one of the reasons you probably are a historian, why you like history, is that you get to learn stuff on your own. So what are some of the big things you learned about the history of Australia and ancient Australia from reading this book, or from writing this book? I'm sure you read it too. Go ahead.
Well, as an historian and not an archaeologist, I've had to embark on a long apprenticeship in archaeology to learn the language of archaeology. And that's been enormous fun. It's opened my eyes to all sorts of, it's been a constant learning process. So the idea for this book actually began about 6 years ago when I managed to wrangle a place on an archaeological excavation on Mirar land in the Northern Territory in Arnhem Land called the Mudjidbebe. It's this beautiful rock shelter, a decorated rock wall leaning out from the Arnhem Land escarpment overlooking the Magella floodplain. And the site had been excavated twice before and had yielded some tantalizing old dates. The aim of the 2012 and 2015 re-excavations was to clarify the age of the site and to gain a more nuanced picture of the cultural environmental history it preserved. But as a historian and not an archaeologist, I had to earn my place on that first excavation as the camp cook. So by day, I would trawl through ancient kitchens and by night, I would cook for a team of hungry archaeologists. And I've tried to keep this outsider's perspective, this cook's view, as it were, throughout this the writing of this book, because that's what's distinct about this book. It's not an history of archaeology from within. It's an assessment from the fringes, anchored in the neighbouring discipline of history. So that's an initial site in Arnhem Land. We spent 7 weeks there in 2012, slowly descending into the earth, troweling our way back in time. And it was this remarkable experience that stirred my imagination about the deep history we're uncovering during the excavation, as well as the cultural and political concerns of our hosts, the Mirar people, who were actually mobilizing the deep time story that we were uncovering in their battles against uranium mining in the area. I just emerged from that thinking there's so much I need to learn in order to understand this story. At so many different scales as well, the scale of the deep time, tens of millennia, into which we were working during the day, but also these very pressing cultural concerns. So the particular thing, the Mirar, we're intrigued about, we uncovered in this burial and in this excavation, a small area of burials, which of course are human remains, not just skeletons, their ancestors, their relatives. Yeah. So it was only with a constant process of communication, consultation, that the archaeological work could continue. And one of the things that the Mirror were wanted to see and allowed, reason they allowed us to continue, was that they wanted to see what the radium levels in these skeletons, these mm-hmm. ancestors were in there, because radium gets trapped in calcium. So you could test the radium before uranium mining came into the area, and then after uranium mining came to the area. And they thought that maybe that would provide them with some more impetus in their campaigns against fighting against uranium mining on their land. Okay. Which, one of many ways in which archaeology is being harnessed by different Aboriginal communities to allow them to control their land and their heritage. I've reprised my role as camp cook many times since, actually, and it's a lot of fun feeding people, and you always end up being at the heart of the best conversations, because they always happen around food. The research for this book has taken me to different archaeological sites in every state and territory of Australia. So,
nice.
Which has continued my learning process, which is just unending learning process. I'm not an archaeologist. I'm still not an archaeologist, and I like to remain that way, because historians, I feel, should be opening their eyes to the deep history that archaeologists are engaging with. I spend most of our time looking across to communicating to historians about all the exciting work that archaeologists are doing. So it's especially nice to talk to some archaeologists about my work.
Nice, nice. Well, I have a question before we move on. Since you've reprised your role as camp cook several times, what is your most well-received meal that you make for the crews?
Well, you've got to work with what you've got available, which is very varied. Probably the most fun I've had cooking, and was very well received, was one day on this working on this excavation at Mudjabebe in Arnhem Land. Mm-hmm. We returned after a day on site to find this beautiful bird, which is called a magpie goose. Sitting on the kitchen table, waiting to be cooked for dinner, and I had only 3 hours before 21 people were coming over, and I frantically had to pluck and behead this beautiful bird and roast it for not just the archaeologists, but some of the traditional owners who came and some other visitors to the site. So mm-hmm. I wasn't expecting to be cooking that, and you always got to be ready for the unexpected when you're working in remote areas.
All right. So moving on from there, what are some of the major questions in Australian ancient history, or Australian archaeology, that still remain to be learned? Because there's always something we can learn, but what are some of the big questions that people are trying to figure out in Australian history?
Yes, well, there's a big new one that's just emerged, and it comes from the excavation I was telling you about at Mudjabebe. So last year, in July last year, a new date was published for the antiquity of Australia of 65,000 years, and that comes from that site I worked on in 2012. Hmm. Nice. It's a dramatic new date, which pushes back the understanding of the other earlier dates around 50,000. And there may be some that are older, but really, until this came out, there was a dominant understanding that people had arrived here about 50,000 years ago. And now we've got this really old date, and we should always be skeptical in archaeology. We should always be suspicious of outliers. But this is an outlier that refuses to be dismissed. It is an outlier that the initial date emerged in 1989 or 1990, and then has been tested and retested again and again. And that's part of the reason we went back in 2015 and took such a long time to publish this date, just to make sure that it was as good as it could be, and given this outlier refuses to be dismissed, it suddenly opens up this new question. It doesn't destabilize what we know about archaeology in other regions, but it presents us with a challenging new question: what happened in the first 15,000 years of Australian history? Why is there this disparity between 65,000 to 50,000? And that vast expanse of time, it really happens that in on that inundated land in the north, it seems, you know, people arrived and they didn't land where our site was in Arnhem Land. They landed many hundred kilometers to the north on what's known as the Sahul Plain, which is now the Arafura Sea. There's this enormous new chapter that's waiting to be answered as the dig directors, Chris Clarkson and Mike Smith posed to me during the excavation. You know, there's that vast submerged history. It's not exactly Atlantis, but it's pretty bloody close.
Nice.
So one of the things that you've been really touching on and talked about beautifully in the book is this sort of complex relationship between existing Aboriginal communities and the archaeological community. And I know that this is something that here in the States we still really struggle with and are still navigating, is how you conduct archaeology that has community input and community benefit. And it sounds like this field school that you've been a part of is really engaging in that. Can you talk a little bit about how, through the course of researching your book, you saw this relationship sort of forming and developing and being leveraged more and more by maybe both sides?
Yes, and that's the core of the book in so many ways, is that that tension, which can be a creative tension between different worldviews coming together over archaeology, that dramatic shift. I talk about this book as a twin revolution: the unraveling of the deep history of Australia, but then also the reassertion of Aboriginal identity, and all that has to all that means for the way you change practices and listening to different voices. And so I moved from the sheer lack of awareness about Indigenous history to now archaeological projects that are being led, not just collaboratively, but being led by Aboriginal communities. The questions that are being asked are posed by the communities that want to find out more about their heritage. They're harnessing archaeology in order to understand in a different way their archaeological, their deep heritage. And I talk about the different practitioners, the change. Isabel McBride was a very significant figure in asking more inclusive questions, asking social questions, saying that if you don't make archaeology accessible to the poetics of different communities, then what's the point in working? You don't have a right to work on their land, on their history. It's not been an easy process. It's been a turbulent and ongoing cross-cultural meeting and with moments of confrontation as well as collaboration. And I write about a lot of those moments of confrontation in the book. But I think it's enormously productive too. And what we see, we emerge from the last half century of these decades of land rights campaigns, these fights for reconciliation, constitutional recognition, and now bringing, you know, Indigenous voices into Parliament. I document that kind of political shift in the book as well. And I think we're living at a really quite exciting moment in Australian history where we could reach some sort of a new step where you can turn back and look at the past and move forward together. And that's been offered by this remarkable event called the Uluru Statement from the Heart, which happened last year. But probably I don't have time to get into in this podcast.
Yeah.
I think that's actually one of the really interesting things about this book is how in many ways Australian archaeology and the interactions between archaeologists and Indigenous communities really mirrors what's happened in the States. And there are these really interesting parallels with how these relationships develop and change and, you know, how Indigenous communities are trying to leverage and use archaeology and the formation of more collaborative relationships instead of sort of, you know, archaeologists had a history of sort of taking from communities and not giving back. And so I think that is a really interesting commentary that comes out of this book. And as an American reader, something that was really interesting.
Oh, I'm glad you picked up those parallels. I see them too. And I think that that's so important. If we are to engage with this deep time story, which is a story that does belong to others often, it has to be done through a lens which acknowledges the contemporary concerns of the creating culture, on the descendants of the creating culture. So if we are to dream of deep time, we must also acknowledge the tumultuous road of the past few centuries and all that has happened and still is happening in that confluence of cultures and histories.
Okay. Well, on that note, I've just got one final question for you, Billy. What's next? What are you researching now? Are you staying in the archaeology realm and sort of ancient history realm, or are you going somewhere else?
Great question. I'm asking myself that too. There's so many loose ends from this project. It's a vast book, continental in scale, yeah. And still there are so many things I left out, and I really want to pursue some of those. I've also, you know, I love the fieldwork aspect of archaeology, so I've signed myself up to a few more digs, and I'm curious to continue in this space. So we'll see. I'm taking some time, but I'm would love to continue writing about archaeology and deep time.
Awesome. Well, we are here to talk about it when you're ready for that.
Thanks, Chris and April. So,
yeah. Well, thank you, Billy. And again, if you want to copy of this book, check it out. You can find it, Deep Time Dreaming, Uncovering Ancient Australia, at the link in the show notes. I'm sure it's in other places as well. Check out the book. It's really great. And again, it's like a history book and an archaeology history book and a biography book all in one. It's really great. I really like the way that the stories are told. So thanks again, Billy. And thank you, April.
It was great being here.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Archaeology Podcast. We hope you enjoyed it. You can provide feedback using the contact button on the right side of the website at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com/archaeology. Or you can email Chris at archaeologypodcastnetwork.com. Please like and share the show wherever you saw it so more people can have a chance to listen and learn. Send us show suggestions and follow ArcPodNet on Twitter and Instagram. This show is produced by the Archaeology Podcast Network. Opinions are solely those of the hosts and guests of the show. However, the APN stands by their hosts. Special thanks to the band Sea Hero for letting us use their song, I Wish You'd Look. Check out their albums on Bandcamp at seahero.bandcamp.com. Check out our next episode in 2 weeks. And in the meantime, keep learning. Keep discovering new things and keep listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network. Have an awesome day. This show is produced and recorded by the Archaeology Podcast Network, Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle, in Reno, Nevada, at the Reno Collective.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.
Thanks again for listening to this episode and for supporting the Archaeology Podcast Network. If you want these shows to keep going, consider becoming a member for just $7.99 a month. That's cheaper than a venti quad eggnog latte. Go to archpodnet.com/members for more info.